This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Lindsay Clancy verdict. We're getting hopefully closer to something, a conclusion of some sort. And we're going to be discussing this in depth today, what went on in that courtroom, not just what we saw on cameras, on the videos that we've seen, but what was it like mere feet away from Lindsay in that room, from the jurors, from the family who was supporting her, from the prosecution that was trying to take her down. Bob Mata is going to be joining us shortly to give us that insight. But the breaking moment or breaking news of the moment, I guess I should say, as we're coming on the air to you this morning live, is that the jury came back this morning saying, surprise, we're deadlocked. and this happens in a lot of cases. This is not, you know, the first time that a jury comes back and says that and then gets sent back, because that's exactly what the judge did. The judge sent them back and said, work a little harder. See if you can figure something out. And that's where we are sitting as of right now. Joining me to begin this discussion, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and masterclass instructor extraordinaire. We'll have the link in the description to go check that out. That is launched now. You can learn from Robin on masterclass now. No shit. I know. It's pretty cool. Let's begin. I mean, are you surprised, Robin, that we're sitting here? What are we? This is day 3, 4? What are we at?
Oh, I had to count up, but I turned the TV off.
I think we're at four. I could be wrong. Yeah, four.
It's four.
They got the hourly
day
count.
Four of deliberations, and we do not have a verdict. Your thoughts?
I think it's good, believe it or not. And I think Bob, when he comes on, I listen to Bob a lot. Matter of fact, and even one of the comments here by Brian Bravo Candy Betch, we listen to each other a lot, and even with Jennifer Coffendeffer on, she's a good friend of all of ours, and we text a lot, and we talk a lot about each other's points of view and flesh them out. And so even when Bob comes on, I remember we've covered a lot of cases with Bob, and he hates it when there's a quick, oh, there he is. Bob, I'm speaking for you for a sec.
He hates it.
I'm going to finish my thoughts, so then you pick up. Bob hates it when the jury comes out quick, means they didn't do their job. And so Tony asked me the question, what I think about the jury still being in deliberation. I said, that's a good thing. It shows they're actually doing the hard work, and this is a hard work case, no doubt. Bob, what do you think about that?
Yeah, so here we are.
Are you guys are aware that they come out in deadlocked, right?
Just talked about that. Yep. Just said that. Right. So that's where the reactions we're making right now.
Doing their job.
Judge sent him back in. From your experience here, what does this mean? What are your thoughts?
So the way that it works in Massachusetts is when the jury sends out a note saying that we're deadlocked, mostly deadlocked, they'll do what they call kind of like a soft jury charge. All right. So before they do what's been referred to as a dynamite charge, an Allen charge, and in Massachusetts it's called a Tui Rodriguez charge. And it's a much more thorough charge to the jury to say, look, you know, we understand it, and it's written out. And the way that the legislature and you know, the appellate courts have looked at the Tui charge is that they recommend that the instruction is read exactly as it's written. So when that happens, and the judge has to have found that there's been thorough and deliberate deliberations, or due and thorough deliberations by the jury before they'll give that heavy duty Tui charge. Because the argument, and there's, you know, a lot of kind of esoteric arguments about these charges, and, you know, are you forcing the jury to go back and to basically bend their will of the way that they feel deep, deep down, even though the instruction says we're not asking you to go against your conscience, okay? And we're not asking you if you have a strongly held belief to put that aside in order to compromise just to come to a verdict. But the thing kind of speaks for itself.
You know, it's like we're kind of asking you to do that, but not directly on paper.
Exactly.
It's kind of like a passive aggressive of, hey, everybody get your shit together and come back with an answer. The judge would really like one.
Exactly.
But I guess how, so it's essentially, you know, for the lay people, a little strongly, more strongly worded encouragement to come back with an answer, essentially.
Yeah. You know, but look, man, I've been saying this since before the trial. Like this is a case where I just don't think, I don't care how many trials, they could try it 100 times.
I don't think we're going to get there.
They're never going to get a verdict on it because people just feel the way they feel about this. The folks that are of the mindset, if you do this to your children, you have to be punished. I don't care what the reason is behind it. I don't care if you were teeming with psychosis. That doesn't matter. The fact is whatever led you to this point where you did this to your own children, you have to be punished. Those folks are never moving off that position, ever. Sure. I don't care how much evidence is put before them. I don't care how many experts take the stand. I don't care if, you know, you have every expert from both sides saying, yeah, she was in psychosis. Those folks are never changing that position. That is how they feel.
Yeah.
And no one's changing their mind out. And you know, when they brought in the manslaughter charge, which I wasn't really a fan of, I understood why it was done. Legally, it doesn't fit with the facts, and it doesn't jive at all with the fact that there is a not guilty by lack of criminal responsibility defense that has been put forth. It doesn't work because by operation of bringing forth that defense, you are saying, look, we're admitting that my client did the acts. Okay, so that's not at issue. What we're saying to you is that she can't be held responsible because of the state of her brain.
Yeah.
And so, like, because with manslaughter, those two things don't work. So it's like a legal fiction that it exists. The thought was that, look, we're going to bring the manslaughter in. I think that M1, like the murder one people would move towards that based on the evidence in terms of the care that she received. I think that they could be, as long as she's going in.
I want to ask you about the murder, about the manslaughter charge a little bit, and what it could possibly mean if they settle on that. So let's say she gets manslaughter. It's a you know, lesser sentence. Yep. So there is a time where she could very realistically be free. It's different than the not guilty by reason of insanity, where she goes into an institution and then has yearly reviews, and you know, may stay in forever.
Yeah.
Manslaughter, there's an end date from that sentence at the prison that she'd be going to. Yeah. From what I understand, Bob, I mean, so in once, like, the not guilty by reason of insanity, doesn't that actually present an opportunity where she could be truly locked up forever, getting mental health care? The manslaughter, that kind of takes it off the table, if I'm understanding that correctly, doesn't it? It's just like, you're going to prison for manslaughter, and when you're out, you're out. And if you need mental health help, well, let's hope you got insurance.
Yeah, I mean, potentially. So there's a range in Massachusetts for manslaughter, and I believe that it's anywhere from 5 to 20 years.
Yep.
And it's 3 counts. So she would be sentenced to each individual child 5 to 20 years, whatever the judge decides in terms of a sentence. Also, based on people that I've spoken to that practice in Mass, it is the judge's discretion as to whether or not he's going to have those sentences run concurrently, which mean at the same time, or consecutively, meaning she does the whatever he sentences her to. Say he sentences her to 20 on Cora, and then the same on Dawson, and then the same on Callan, which would be a 60-year sentence ultimately. And in truth in sentencing requires that they serve, I believe it's 85%. It might be
two-thirds is what I looked up this morning, I think,
yeah,
Bob.
Yeah, so
two-thirds of the sentences before they're eligible for parole.
Right. So, you know, that's a thing. And the difference between murder one is it's mandatory life.
Like, yep, no
discretion in it, no parole. You're done. You're in. You're over with. So, you know, and my thing with this case has been, you know, when you talk about the concept of whether or not Reddington should have advised his client, maybe this is the one where we go a bench trial as opposed to going to a jury on it. And I wasn't sure. I thought that somebody had emailed me something when I had made that first kind of suggestion or put that thought out there. If this was a case where maybe you're going to the judge and saying, all right, look, you know, we think this is a bench trial. It's a very difficult issue to decide, you know, but with a judge, you're not getting a hung jury. ever. Yeah. Right? Yeah. You know, you're like the judge is making a decision one way or another. But I thought that somebody had sent me an email saying that on M1 in Massachusetts that you couldn't waive jury, but I don't think that that's correct. Like I've never heard of not being able to waive your right to a jury, but I'm not going to die on that hill because I haven't looked up the law in Massachusetts. So, but as to your other point, yeah, I mean, if, and it's not just if she is a danger to others, it's, is she a danger to herself?
Yeah.
And I don't know that there's ever going to be a day that Lindsay Clancy isn't going to be a danger to herself.
Yeah, I agree.
You know what I mean? You mm-hmm. can have the same thing where she's healthy enough mentally in there to be able to put on the mask. Like, oh, yeah, no, you know, I'm not, I have no desire to end my own life anymore. And that's all just a mask, you know? And then she's, because right now she's still one-on-one. She has somebody watching her 24/7 because she's still a risk of unaliving herself. So, you know, in theory, yeah, I mean, she could stay in there for the rest of her natural life. And I'm talking about the mental health facility, you know, but the problem is that the concept, and it was the thing that ultimately, and I don't think that would have mattered in Gacy, but when Bill Kunkel, the lead prosecutor in Gacy, suggested that there exists a possibility in the world that John Wayne Gacy could be cured and he could be released back into society. Like, you can imagine what the jury was thinking about that concept. They were like, their heads exploded, their eyes rolled back in their skulls. They were like, what? You know, like, and obviously that was objected to. I don't know that it ever should have been brought out in front of the jury, because once those words were uttered, that there was even a remote chance that this dude's going to be out on the streets again, that was it. You know, and it was like, that was a case, like, he's the poster boy for the death penalty. I'm anti-death penalty as a general proposition, but, you know, there's exceptions to
that. Yeah, so I looked it up. Massachusetts, first-degree murder is the exception. You cannot request bench trial in Massachusetts on that.
There you go. So that person was correct.
And the interesting, there's so many interesting things this, Bob. It's been so mentally exhausting. To the point, if this was going on, because when I... You know, my legal side is not nearly as strong as anyone else's because I spent my time on behavior stuff. But, you know, if this is being tried, and as I got it right here, Idaho, Kansas, Montana, Utah, and Alaska, you know, this wouldn't even be a discussion because it is like a lot of people want. Just guilty, killed their kids, and then we're going to use these as mitigating factors for sentencing, which is the... The incongruence just in the legal system on cases like this across our country is actually quite mind-boggling to me, because when you're doing these deep dives to try to understand where people are coming from and why they have a certain point of view, when you see where people live, you see their experiences, and then I'm not even bringing in the religious aspect of this because people have that aspect as well. It's easy to see why people are so divided, because our country is extremely divided on one simple, not simple. This is the most complex thing I've ever faced and looked at in my life as well. I've probably done more, again, I'm sorry about the me statements in this case about them. I have learned more on this case because I've covered this case as well as doing your Gacy files at the same time. My mind is legally exploding trying to understand it all, because this is extremely complex.
It really is, man.
Yeah, there's so many elements to this thing, and I want to talk about what was going on in the courtroom. But I want to address one quick question here that I saw that someone had posted about the pharmacist. So I think it's a valid question to a certain extent, but I think the answer might surprise a lot of people. No one mentions the pharmacists who dispensed her medications. Why did they not flag all the meds that were being prescribed at their possible conflicting side effects? Because this shit happens all the time, everywhere you look.
Yep.
And because this is normal. That's why.
That's what it's become.
Yeah.
Like, throw the drugs at them. Like, they receive no actual therapy, you know, and you had a situation here where none of the providers, not one of them, did a blood draw to see what was in her system.
Yeah.
You know, because you have Lindsay reporting.
Yep.
And it's one thing to assume that your patient is being accurate, you know, and truthful about what they've been prescribed. But no one was doing the homework. Not one provider was looking and seeing what the other providers had prescribed to her. nor were they looking at her blood to see what she was actually taking and what was in her system. So, you know, I mean, that's part of the problem. Like, we don't know, as we sit here now, and we've gone through all the evidence in this case, we have no idea if, in fact, we go all the way back to the Zoloft as being the trigger for where we ended up in January. Yeah. So when we go from September to January and she gets this cocktail, this polypharmaceutical cocktail, and where we don't know, as to the excellent comment that was just made, we don't know how they're interacting with one another. And more importantly, her healthcare providers did not know how they were interacting with one another. And then on top of it, they were continuing to prescribe other medications, not knowing how they were playing with one another. And I'm talking about the pharmaceuticals within her mind. And then you have to be able to consider the fact that, number one, she had stopped breastfeeding in October, which adds a whole nother element to this case, which really Reddington kind of threw in there with respect to the cross of one of their, because there was a woman that was supposed to be testifying on behalf of the defense, and her name was Margaret Spinelli. And she's kind of the authority in the world in terms of postpartum depression, postpartum psychosis. She would have been the one who would have been explaining to the jury, educating the jury on what happens within a woman's body, hormonally speaking, before, during, and after when they give birth. You know, and that is like kind of a gaping hole in this thing in terms of just fleshing out, trying to figure out how this thing ended up the way that it did. Because it's not as simple as the people that are wanting an eye for an eye.
No.
And I understand it. I understand that those folks exist in the world, and it's very simple. We're a revenge-driven society. That's how this country has always been. The problem for me and my rebuttal to those folks is quit ignoring our brains. I mean, what is more important in terms of figuring out for the quality of life purpose than understanding what the hell is going on in our brains? Because if you think the DSM and psychologists and psychiatrists aren't doing anything other than practicing, which is exactly why they call it, we practice medicine, we know so little about the human mind that it requires us to move the needle in terms of mental illness in this country and really give it the attention that it requires, because we've talked about this on the last three lives, man. Yeah. All you need to do is scroll through social media for 20 fucking minutes and you see what is going on in this country. It is constant chaos every single place I look.
And it's normalized, and we're used
to it.
It's
normal.
And we feel weird without it almost. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I looked up, and just talking about the pharmaceutical side of things, I did look up responsibility, culpability, not necessarily in that way, but to try to understand what they could or couldn't have done and how it wasn't flagged. And so what it came back with was these were common prescriptions for mental health. And so that didn't flag because of the types of prescriptions. They were done in series and not in parallel, basically. So they weren't on top of each other. So that wouldn't have flagged anything for interactions.
Yeah. There was nothing to flag.
And the other thing, too, is a lot of the flags that happen inside of pharmacies, it's program driven. In other words, the software doesn't flag it. And so if you have multiple providers that aren't talking, because that's the other thing, too, is it wasn't just one provider. So it wouldn't have flagged anything. Multiple different providers, common prescriptions, and in series and not in parallel. So they didn't have to look at interactions. That was actually part of the reason why it got missed,
well, and a lot of obviously. It's like we said yesterday, like it's like, okay, you're going to be on 10 milligrams of this. Oh, that's not working for you. We're going to up it to this. Oh, we're going to lower you to this. So you consistently have a bottle of pills that has about 25 in because they keep changing it. Now, why the doctors were changing it that frequently, that's what needs to be seriously examined, and why they couldn't communicate with one or the other. I get why the pharmacy filled them. The pharmacy's following the directives of the doctors. These are not medications that are typically abused to a level like you would have for pain pills or things of that nature. These are not those types of drugs. People aren't popping these super right. recreationally or anything like that. So they're not the type that typically get that sort of scrutiny. And they're just typically up or done. We're talking, it was 30 different prescriptions, but 13 meds in total that were being adjusted up and down over the course of the time. So that's, I mean, it makes sense to understand how we got here, but why the system allowed us to be there is the bigger question. I got one more question in this segment before we move to the next one. You were in the courtroom for a good chunk of this thing. You were in there. Patrick's there. Lindsay's there. The families are there. We're seeing it on a screen. There's something very different about being in that actual gallery, though. Yeah. The emotional reality of what everybody was going through. How would you describe what it felt like in there?
Heavy.
Yeah.
Incredibly heavy. You know, it's like you're, and it's funny because, you know, they'll take breaks. You're sitting in the courtroom. You can hear a pin drop. You know, I mean, like you feel the weight of the courtroom. You feel, you know, just the overall power of being in that room, because everybody feels it. You know, the jury's feeling it, the attorneys feel it, the gallery feels it, obviously the defendant feels it, the family. It's just, it's the equivalent to really kind of what I was really hoping that Reddington, and I'm never critical of him because I think he's absolutely phenomenal. He's one of the best litigators in the country when it comes to criminal defense law. But the one thing that I would have loved for him to been able to kind of like highlight for the jury is the fact that you have Dr. Resnick, who is the preeminent psychiatrist, psychologist, I can't remember which one he is, on the planet in terms of filicide and in terms of his work on malingering with respect to hallucinations, mm-hmm. you know, whether determining whether or not somebody's lying or yep. over-reporting with respect to hallucinations. So, but you had him on a screen, right? So you're sitting yeah. there. So, because if you'll remember when Tufts was on the stand, Dr. Jennifer Tufts, and, you know, Red kept referring to it. Oh, so that was via television, right? It was a funny little thing in terms of the way that he did it. But he was doing it intentionally to drive home the point that there's a massive difference between looking at somebody on a screen and being in the same room as that person. Mm-hmm. And the stark contrast is when you think about the Commonwealth's two experts, forget about Mack. But, you know, we'll talk about Heilbrunn and what is it, Satoff. They were in the room, you know, and they would turn and look at the jury when they were giving an answers. The jurors could observe what they were doing with their hands. They could observe everything that they were doing when they were sitting on the stand. And I would have liked to have heard Reddington in order to contrast the treatment that Lindsay got through these telehealth appointments. And again, I'm not shitting on telehealth, but yeah. there is a difference between having somebody in your office for a personal one-on-one human connection consultation and looking at them on a screen.
Yeah.
You know, if you were in the room with Tony, Robin, and I, and we were having a discussion, it would feel vastly different than you sitting at home watching us on your computer or your television. Mm-hmm. It's just a different experience. And I would have liked to have seen Red point that out. I wanted him to say, I want you to think about the preeminent expert on these two areas that we discussed and how you felt about watching him on a screen, and think about the difference that you felt when you were listening to the Commonwealth's expert who was sitting 6 feet away from you. You know, that feeling that you're feeling in terms of, yeah, that was a different experience. That's what I want you to understand about the care that Lindsay received. And I think it would have really driven that home, because, you know, again, at the end of the day, and in Robin, everything that you pulled up with respect to the pharmaceuticals is important, but what's also important is that she clearly, in my estimation, had a manic episode mm-hmm. after Dawson was born. And Tufts was completely unaware of it.
I agree.
If she was in mania during and after Dawson was born, and she's not aware of it, and she prescribes her an SSRI, that's what I'm saying. That could have been the impetus of everything that happens thereafter. It's like, and then she's having the reaction that you're not supposed to have in terms of helping her sleep. It made her worse. It made her more anxious. It increased her insomnia. So these red flags went up, and then Tufts never did anything to go back to try to figure it out. Her solution was to say, all right, well, we'll switch up the meds. And we'll give this one a shot, and we'll give this one a shot. And again, my view is, if we could be a fly on the wall in Jennifer Tufts, having a drink with her friend after work one day, and she's just talking about some of her patients. She's like, "Oh yeah, I got a real pain in the ass." She's a nurse. She knows it all. I keep trying to help her. I don't know if she's overreporting. You know what I mean? It's like, it's that thing where. I can't remember. I've made the comparison so many times. Where if I've represented an attorney in a case,
they can be the biggest pain in the ass client.
Oh my God! Well, dude, I'm telling them, we're not collaborating on this.
It's Alec Murdaugh. Representing. Exactly. Don't take the stand. Don't take the stand, and he takes the stand.
Exactly.
They're not. I mean, they're going to make decisions that may not be in their best interest because of ego to a certain extent. Right. But again, that still and that's I hear that argument too. Well, she made these choices. Yes, she didn't make the choice to fall into a state of psychosis, though. You can make dumb choices. You can make ignorant choices. You can make choices that are not going to that are not going to be great for you. And of course, you're going to make a lot of them when you're not in a good mental state. But again, and none of it erases the fact of here's what your brain ended up doing to you on top of the cocktail of medications that you've been going on and off of. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to break down the Lindsay Clancy case as the jury is still out as of this recording. Bob Mata is with us today as we continue to break down our conversation about Lindsay Clancy and where this is going to go with a jury, depending on guilty or not guilty by reason of insanity or manslaughter. There's many places where this can land. You were in that courtroom for quite some time these last few weeks. We saw Lindsay Clancy on our screens. We saw many times where they shut down court because she was getting very emotional and upset, and I think understandably so, if we're looking at it from an empathetic window, to be confronted with these horrific images of what you caused while you were in your state of alleged psychosis. What was she like in that courtroom? We talk about defendants in courtrooms all the time, from Lori Vallow to Corey Richens to Donna Adelson. All of them have their interesting affects and how the jury is receiving them. Bob, how would you say the jury was receiving Lindsay Clancy in that room?
It's so hard to read them,
Yeah.
And there was, I talked about the one juror that many of my friends in the media are of the mindset was dead set on convicting Lindsay, that she was very pro prosecution in the case. But she was oddly the one who, when Lindsay had the two breakdowns the day that they were going through the second and third autopsies of the kids, and they had to stop court a couple times. And she was the only witness who was, just without flinching, looking at Lindsay the entire time. Many of the jurors would kind of glance over and then break it off. She was watching her. She had a tissue and she dabbed her eyes a couple times. And you don't know what she's feeling. Is she thinking about the kids? Is she feeling sympathy for Lindsay? There's many things that could be going through her mind. And it's like, everybody who wants to play like they can get a read on what somebody's thinking are full of shit.
Yeah.
I've been trying to do it for 20 plus years at trial, and I never got it right. It's like the people that'll, kill them with kindness. The guy that was always smiling at me when I was, arguing or making a point when a cross examination, I was like, I go back to the table. I'm like, I think that one juror likes me. He smiles at me sometimes. You know, and then that would be the guy who was leading the charge for conviction
sure.
at the end of the day. So you just, you can't really get a sense of it. And you know, and I didn't have to be able to read the jurors' faces to know how this thing was going to go. I've been saying it since the first time we did a live on this. I am of the mindset that there, I don't care how many times they try this case. Because of the state of our country, because of the massive divide on people and how they view murder, and in particular, a mother murdering her own children or killing her own children, they are never going to be moved off the sentiment that she needs to be punished to the fullest sure. extent of the law, whether in a state that had the death penalty, which Massachusetts does not, that they think that she should be put to death in a state where it's life in prison, that's where she should be. And there's, you're never changing their mind on that.
Yeah.
And the same goes for the folks that are like myself and you too, where we believe that something went terribly wrong here, that there's no other explanation but for the fact that she was in a psychotic state when this happened. And for me, I cannot hold somebody criminally responsible if their body is basically a puppet to a diseased mind. And it's just a place I'm not willing to go, because I have a deep understanding of mental illness. I have a deep understanding of the fact that if something is being done and it's not at your own volition, meaning that you're not the one controlling it, which is so hard for some people to buy into. People are like, that makes no sense. Like a person that's lived 70 years of their life and never had anything even remotely like that. There's never been one minute in my life where I didn't have control of my own senses and my own mind, you know? And they're like, for them, it's impossible for them to get to the point where I can't imagine that being a real thing.
Yeah.
It sounds like some movie bullshit.
They're also the same folks who aren't able to see anything from anyone else's perspective ever.
Right. Well, I mean, they're the folks that you can't have an intelligent conversation with, which is, you know.
And so on the hypothetical with the one juror that you said was so deadlocked on of guilt, and whether it's her or someone else, this is generally the way that, you know, I've seen this throughout as well. When someone starts out with a locked-in negative confirmation bias, in other words, they're not doing their job as a juror to take in all the data and remain open-minded according to the law and the instructions that are given. When they're looking, these are the ones that, when you're trying to figure out what they're doing because they're just staring intently, I'm not saying this case, but typically what they're doing is they're trying to have their own confirmation biases from what they're observing. See, look, I saw this. I knew they were lying, because we all know people that are following this case that no matter what you say, no matter what argument you put up, no matter what observations and doctors saying there, she's not being deceptive, without a flinching, they think everything coming out of her mouth is complete lie, complete fabrication, and they think the emotions that they're watching and witnessing is completely fraud. And so they're having a very passive, negative, or just neutral affect to it because they don't believe what they're seeing. And the last point I want to make is this is just so profoundly dumbfounding to me that, like you said, Bob, you have those people that are on that side, and the three of us are seeing the mental health issue here. And in this context, it's a discussion, the jury's debating it. It still blows my mind that if we were doing the same thing in Kansas, this wouldn't even be a discussion. Our point of view wouldn't even matter. It wouldn't even come up on the jury. She'd be guilty. Yeah. And then, I mean, it just, that's what is just so mind boggling to me, that our country is not even unified in the code of justice.
Well, I like it.
Or
the facts of the matter. Well, but it's worse than that, because the reality is that there's statutes in place.
Yeah.
You have this law, this statute that allows for a defendant to come into a court of law that has been written by the legislature in every state aside from Idaho, which they have like a carve out. They have a carve out where you can attack the mens rea and the intent portion of a statute, saying like they could not form the requisite intent to have committed the crime. But, you know, and people just are incapable or unwilling to apply the law that the lawmakers have seen fit to draft. And like we call it the defense of last resort for a reason, because of exactly what we're talking about. This isn't a new concept. This is forever been the case. And it always boils down to, do people believe it, to two things, really. Do people believe that mental illness exists in the sense that it truly does, meaning that someone can and do lose control of their mind? And the other part of it is the morality argument, in terms of, if you murder someone, and murder, just so you all understand, these are homicides. Murder is a legal construct, okay? Murder is a legal term that we use. You can have homicides that are justified, such as, you know, if it's self-defense, defense of others, you know, if cops have to put somebody down and it's a good shooting, those are justifiable homicides. So finding murder is where you, you know, have malice aforethought. You know what I'm saying? So that's where you're going in with the intent to kill somebody purposefully. Okay. So that's a different thing. Manslaughter is a different charge. But, you know, kind of the way that I always try to like break through with people, I'm like, let's talk about war. Let's talk about the men and women that protect us, that enlist for various reasons, many because they have no other option, but they enlist in the military and they're sent off to a war, which we may not even know why they're being sent off for that war, but they have been trained to kill, right? They go and kill at will. Like, you know, that is their job. Your job is to go and kill the enemy. And this is going to the morality side of it. Like I want people to try to think, like what is the difference if people are, our soldiers or any soldiers anywhere are being sent off to be a part of an unjust war, or think about Muslims who flew into the World Trade Center and their people were like, well, this is righteous. You know, what you're doing is righteous in their estimation. And they come over and they kill 3,000 Americans because they flew planes into a building. We're looking at that as murder, right? They're looking at that as justifiable in their estimation. My point being is that when one human being kills another person, the way that we're determining whether or not it's criminal is strictly a human construct.
Yeah, it's based on our perspective and our prism of where we are sitting. And that's very much how that plays. I want to ask you this, because this has been brought up quite a bit in this case. People are criticizing the police investigation into these deaths. I've been seeing it quite a bit on the conspiracy threads where people are still going down the road of Patrick and all that. Is this a case and I don't know the answer to this, should there have been more investigation police work-wise to simply answer some of the questions that people have that they say, well, there are no answers to this because this X wasn't investigated? I've seen that attached to various elements of this case. But there are some cases where it is just so clear. Clean cut, there's not much more to investigate. But how do you know unless you do? Bob, what's your thoughts on people who are criticizing that?
I think the criticism of the investigation is fair.
Okay.
You know, but we're talking about two separate things. Do I think that the people that are accusing Patrick Clancy of doing this are ridiculous? Yes.
Yeah.
I do. But that's a different thing.
But this is where it's like you always just want to make sure the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted to shut down the bullshit.
Exactly.
And had there been a good investigation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Had there been a thorough investigation, the people that are saying, well, you know, we're just taking Patrick's word on this because they didn't investigate shit, that gives them a fuel.
Yeah.
By way of them not doing what they should have done, which was
I think they would have said it anyway.
You know what? it's the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of saw it with Ellen Greenberg, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not unique to this case. There's plenty of cases where it's like, why didn't they investigate further? Right. And there really isn't always a great explanation other than incompetence.
I mean, that's the bottom line. It's indifference or incompetence, laziness. I don't know what it is. It's a combination.
I'm going to give him some grace. I think it's a shock too. I mean, so when you roll up on a scene like this in a place where you least expect it, and then it's obvious because again, I'm just talking human nature, is I'm trying to place myself in that situation. So you roll up on it, you see the horror of it, you can quickly assess visually what happened, and then, and wherever, whenever she became literate, you know, with her words, some are saying on, I know that's the big debate, although it's very clearly she wasn't speaking on scene, but where she immediately, pretty soon after, says, I did it. As an investigator, you're going to focus your resources and attention on a different aspect of the case rather than collecting evidence because she said she did it. Again, I'm just talking from small town, you know, collectors, investigators. You know, it could have been better, but when have we ever had a case where they shouldn't have done or could have done a better job investigating?
That's true.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're 100%, and like you said, Robin. I mean, the bottom line is that law enforcement are all human beings.
Yeah.
You know, which brings a bigger question up to mind, which is, you know, are these investigating officers, or whether they're first responders, first on the scene, you know, are they offered and do they accept the counseling that they probably need?
No.
Because if you think that you walk into a scene like that as a human being, I don't give a shit if you have a badge on your chest. You are seeing shit that will scar you for the rest of your life. And, you know, are these folks getting the help that they need after the fact or while it's happening? You know, I mean, like that's and again, you're going to have the macho guys who are like, oh, fuck it. I'm fine, man. I'm going to rub some dirt on it. You know what I mean? Those are the guys that kind of think that the mental health world is bullshit, you know, that psychs are all fucking, you know,
and like even
shrinks,
so
and bullshit, you know, all that stuff.
Being right there for 9/11, watching 8 people jump from the North Tower, being 5 blocks away during that entire thing, side by side with NYPD during this entire thing, out of Fresh Kills landfill, finding body parts to give back to families, and months and months after, some email coming around, if you want to talk to someone, here's a number. And then watching suicide, self-elimination skyrocketing in NYPD and Port Authority and FDNY around me, it was profound. And you know what the counseling we had was? We had a roving chaplain that was walking around Fresh Kills landfill saying, hey, does anyone want to talk? And when that impacts your career, because people start giving you the label of, oh man, the guy's a psych job, you know, do you take it up? I don't know anyone. Now, I'll say they didn't, but I'm not aware of anyone that took up that resource, and that's watching some severe horror.
That's what I'm saying. And it's the same with our soldiers. Yeah. Who I mm-hmm. love and respect. There never goes a day when I don't see somebody that served in the military where I don't thank them for their service, because I have a deep understanding if they were in the shit, their psyche has been destroyed. Mm-hmm. They are never going to be the person that they were prior to going into combat.
Yeah.
That you can't be. You can't. Something fundamentally changes in you. The things that we are grown up being told are completely unacceptable, mm-hmm. and that's taking another person's life. It doesn't matter what the context is, whether it's like you're in a war. This is what we have to do. This is what you have to do. The fact of the matter is, the thing that we've been told is verboten, that is immoral, that is against everything that we believe in terms of our laws, our religion. That it's okay in this sense, but in your mind, it's not. And you know, these, like every soldier that I know that was in the shit, and going back to, you know, I'm younger, so obviously, you know, my grandfather was WW2 age. My father didn't serve in Nam because he was already in college. But every friend that I had that has served in any of the Middle Eastern wars that we have and have come back are damaged.
Yeah,
they're damaged, and they know it, and they accept it, and they acknowledge it, and they want help, and they're feeling it every day of their life. They feel like they don't fit into society anymore. Everything looks strange and different. And you know, the care that they get is not the care that they should be getting. You know what I mean? And it's like, I just, you know, my thing with the mental health awareness thing that I'm so just adamantly advocating for is because it fucking matters. It matters.
It's the most important thing in our bodies. It controls everything we do and everything we communicate, and we treat it like it's one of the least. We treat it like it's your tonsils or so. Like, not a big deal. We'll get those out. You know, like, it's your brain.
It's it.
And we have so little understanding of it, so little grace for it, and so little desire, it seems, as a society, to try and understand it better, because it's scary. And I think fear is the ultimate motivator for us not to understand it more than we do already. 100%. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to break down the Lindsey Clancy trial. The jury, as of this recording, is still out. They've already come back once and said, we can't get to a verdict. The judge has sent them back. Bob Mata, defense attorney, is with us, along with Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. So let's play it out. Let's go down the scenario of they do come back with a hung jury. There is no verdict. Will the Commonwealth try this again? We were talking in another segment about you can't do a bench trial on a first-degree murder charge. Do they recharge it to go to a bench trial just so we can get through this damn thing with some sort of conclusion? Or do they keep hitting their head against a wall over and over, and Lindsey Clancy is going to be tried until she's in her 80s? My prediction is she probably makes an exit on her own fruition before we get there. But what do you think happens here, Bob, if they do have a hung jury?
I don't know. I honestly don't. Like, I've been saying before the trial started, I've told you, like, and we've agreed on that. Like, I've practiced for a long time, and I can't think of a more difficult case for a jury to try to reach a verdict on. And it's basically because of the things we've been talking about in our last two segments. You have people of the mindset, like, you know, I mean, we could just look through our chat, you know, Palm Tree G wanting help and actually following through properly on that help are two different things. And Lindsey Clancy neglected the latter part. I disagree completely. I absolutely disagree completely. I think she did. I'm going to go ahead and take Lindsey's mother-in-law, Sue Clancy's, word over yours, Palm Tree, and what she said on the stand when she testified on behalf of her ex-daughter-in-law, who had ended the life of her grandchildren, was that begging for help. She called the suicide hotline twice. They said, well, you don't have a plan. We're going to give you some resources. Here's a pamphlet. Good luck with that. She tried to get into the postpartum program at Women's and Children in Rhode Island. They said they took her in for a day. They said, unfortunately, we can't allow you into the program because you're over-medicated. She went in for 5 days at a skeleton crew at McLean. And basically, she said, you know, I'd like to get home for my kid's birthday. They said, well, you know, you seem like you're doing better. Pats her on the head and gets her out. When she was there, the therapy she received was, you know, doing a little coloring, playing with some clay. And
yeah, I thought that was interesting. Coloring in clay.
As long as we're able to tell ourselves that we're attending to them. They're getting their service and we're checking a box, but we're not actually checking what we're checking the box for. That's
we
become a society of check the box so we feel good and we can tell ourselves we've done the right thing. But what's actually being done is shit.
Bob, I got a question for you.
I would ask Palm Tree, what else should she have done?
Well, and that's my question. So Coffin Duffer asked me a question yesterday I didn't have an answer for because I couldn't think of anything. I want to know if you have one. Coffin Duffer asked, so did Lindsey do anything wrong?
Ever, is basically. But, did she do anything wrong throughout this entire ordeal?
I think she underreported. But she underreported because that's how women are, right? Well, but everyone does. Every woman, if you talk to women that have gone through it, and are talking about how they don't feel comfortable bringing forth everything that they may be going through out of fear of consequences, whether it be I lose my kids, I lose my nursing license, my husband leaves me. I get sectioned and I'm stuck in a like all those really that to me, that's where this lives. Like there has to be legislation. I have somebody on my live right now. Her name's Lisa Tremaine. She has an amazing clinic and she's got 47 women in there with their kids right now that she brings them all in. She brings in the women, they're allowed to report fully what's going on with them with no repercussions. It's all confidential. The kids are there, so they continue the mother-child bond. The women are monitored constantly. They then bring in the families. What this woman is doing is incredible.
Yeah. And
that woman, Lisa Tremaine, who is based out of New Jersey, she saves lives.
Hmm.
If Lindsay Clancy had been aware of Lisa Tremaine, had gone in, and even just brought Callan with her so that she could work it through, whether it takes, and they live there. Mm-hmm. They live in this in this center, and they receive the treatment on a daily basis. And it doesn't matter how long it takes. When they're good, that's when they leave. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if it takes a week, if it takes months. That's what was missing here. Yeah. And it's what's missing all over this country. And for me to see women that turn on a woman who clearly was going through it, because there's one thing that's not at debate anymore. Like, everybody agreed, she had a mental disease or defect. Now, people are, you know, the sides are arguing about exactly what it was.
Yeah.
But there was no question in terms of this case that she had a mental disease or defect at the time of these homicides.
Everyone agreed.
So, you know, I mean, for me, man, it's like my hope has been that these children, these beautiful children that lost their lives, who we all care about. There's no more disgusting comment than saying that when we're talking about trying to focus on stopping this from happening in the future and using this case as the jump off point to really have the discussions and have the law changed so that women can feel free to do what Lisa Tremaine is doing, because women don't feel like they can be completely honest about what's going on for all the reasons that I just discussed. So when they underreport, this is the result you can get. Now, this is obviously the worst case scenario. And this was, you know, you can't forget the fact that we're like in the second year or for like in the middle of the, I don't know what, like a year and a half into the shutdown, and we're just coming out of it. Telemedicine had become the norm.
Yeah.
Because that was the only way. Like, it was this perfect storm of shit that was going on. On top of the fact that she just wasn't receiving the treatment that she needed, you can't just throw drugs at people without the other part of it, which is the actual therapy. You know, you can't have it where if she says, I'm having intrusive thoughts, and you ask one question about it, well, what? Oh, well, you know, of like harming myself or my kids. And then you don't follow up and say, well, I need details. Like, any good doctor is going to say, I need more. I need to hear everything that you're thinking. Like, that never took place with her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't know what she's disclosing to her mother or her husband. We know from her journal, you know, that she was feeling the distance between her and Pat growing because this had been going on for 4 months. You know, a woman is going to be conscious of the fact that, like, you know, I've been going through this for 4 months and I'm like torturing my husband. And, you know, I get the arguments that Pat should have said, you know what, fuck it. You get into that bed and you get right. I want to take care of everything. And like, and that's a fair argument.
And it
that's
wasn't a fair just him, assessment. Though. The whole family stood by her. That's what is still the most unbelievable thing to me. When everyone argues anything on this, that it, with their opinion on the outside, I said, I stand with the family. I stand with the family on what their assessment of her was, because it's, I've never seen anything so congruent. I'm curious what it's going to look like at sentencing, no matter what happens, and when the victim impact statements get up. They, you know, they stand with her. They saw something was wrong. They saw the break, you know, after the fact, because again, everyone's got the armchair quarterback going, you know, after everything happened. And there's no unhealthy wobbles prior to that on behalf of family or observers.
I'm a northerner, but I live in the South now, and so I've actually taken up a colloquialism of the South, bless your heart, during this. and that's something I never used in my life. I never really know what it meant. I know what it means now, and I've been saying it.
That means you're a nutter.
Well, no, it means you have no experience. Yourself.
It means it pretty much means that. It means essentially you say it when someone has no clue what the hell they're talking about, but they really think they know what they're talking about. Right. And there's so many people in this case that are watching it, and bless your heart, everyone is free to their own opinion without a doubt, but you can so spot someone who has never had any experience in their life with mental health crises of their own or people immediately around them by the way they react to this case. And bless your heart that you've never had that. Thank God you've never had that, because I too was just as ignorant as some of these comments before I encountered the insanity of what mental health crises can be like in your life. And you start trying to understand them and you try to start making sense of it and you learn a lot more and you educate yourself a lot more and you end up with a very different understanding than the kind of closed off world that we all come into until we're actually confronted with these sort of nightmares head on. And once you've hit it head on, you don't ever see things the same way again. And there's a lot of people who, again, bless their hearts, have never had to be there. Consider yourself fucking lucky. Consider yourself lucky. Preach. Shut the fuck up.
Preach.
It's kind of, it's kind of what I feel like.
There's people out there saying, God bless it. You know, bless their hearts to the three of us too, I'm sure.
So. Yeah, I'm sure.
I'm sure like there too, but you know what?
Chicken Chow Mein saying it.
Right. Fucking lived it. So I can speak on it a bit. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's, living in a world with someone who's going, I never had postpartum psychosis with a partner, but I had depression that she was going through and a bunch of other shit too. And oh my God, I mean, it is, I have a ton of empathy for Patrick and everybody who's like, you should have done this. You should have done that. Should he have checked with you on TikTok first before he took a breath and then went out and had a night to himself to breathe after 3 years of after three children and postpartum every time and the headache and the nightmare and the emotionally, you know, soul destroying moments that come along with it? Should he have never done anything to take a breath for himself? Should he have not found love in 3 years and 3 years too soon? I mean, it's just fucking maddening
to try to fill the gaping hole
in their lives with attacking someone else trying to find sanity.
The loss of the three children, the loss of his wife, God. Because that's not his wife, that's still alive. And then I still can't, because again, we're talking about the war issue and people in combat, the survivor's guilt he must have. I can't even fathom, you know, because all these things that people are piling on him on, do you think he hasn't thought that a million times over the last 3+ years, every single day of his life that how could he not think in terms of, if I had only done this, I'd have three babies still. Let alone the loss of them. So that's why, like,
when I lost
my cool on Friday with that same con, yeah. I lose it on these things when don't ever assume how parents feel about their kids and place your own shit on it, because you are way off the mark.
Well, it's a good thing Karen in Paducah is here to keep us all on the up and up.
Look, man, I just want to say this before we wrap. I am so, so thankful that you two guys in particular are in my life, especially in a case like this. It can feel lonely out there.
Yes,
as a man, you know, speaking on this, because in terms of postpartum, we have no fucking business talking about it.
Yeah.
But in terms of the importance and the understanding of mental health and mental illness, man, to have two guys like you that are of the same mindset is so fucking important to me. So I thank you
and both likewise,
for being the men that you are.
Try being a law enforcement guy, former FBI, standing like this. I'm standing against everyone as well.
I know, man.
It's just crazy.
And everyone who's standing up and really taking the time, I really appreciate it. I do, you know, this is an interesting case where there is a lot of dig in and people aren't going to change their opinions. But honestly, I've in this case, more than others recently, I have seen from a lot of comments of, I went into it this way, and you know what? I'm thinking about it differently because I educated myself. That's good. That's all anyone asks is just take the time, absorb the information, let it stew a little bit, and then come out. Don't come back with the bumper sticker answer the moment you hear the name.
And no,
take a moment.
And we're not trying to say free her. No, I want her locked away and getting help. The only add is that I'm adding the end getting help, you know, but locked away. Hell yeah. What are you? Absolutely. Yeah. Everyone, that's where
she
we're
needs
all
to be locked away and hell get the help that she needs. Yeah. All right. We'll wrap it up. Your thoughts in the comments section. Bob, you're still live over on Defense Diaries right now?
Indeed.
Send him over there. Go check out Defense Diaries right after this. You're going to be continuing over there, and I'm sure the conversation's going to be great. So continue the live coverage and watch it over on Defense Diaries and press subscribe wherever you get the podcast. Robin, he has a new masterclass out.
Oh, yeah.
It just dropped late last week. Robin, tell them more.
Yeah, my class on masterclass is Be the Person Everyone Trusts. How do you become the person everyone trusts? Critical thinking, basically what we're talking about here, is how do you have deep empathy to understand other people from the standpoint so you can make those connections and be the person that everyone wants in their lives and trust.
I'll put the link in the description or a masterclass. Search Robin Dreek and you will find his class. So go check that out. All right, press subscribe. We'll continue our conversation in the comments. Go over to Defense Diaries if you're watching us right now, and he'll pick up more coverage over there.
Listen to Buried.
And Buried too. All right. Until next time, for Robin, for Todd, for Bob, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.